2. Late in a September afternoon, coming past the orchards of Valtorsa, where the golden light shone broken by transparent walls of shadow that stretched eastward from each row of trees, Itala saw his sister come towards him on the road.
"Letter,"
she called.
"Uncle brought it."
And then, when they met,
"Are the grapes ready to pick?"
"We'll pick the Oria vines tomorrow."
As they walked side by side, he opened the letter and read it, frowning against the level sunlight. It was dated from Solari. "Dear Itala, the old count writes that you are home. So am I. I was released on the 20th, got as far as Kolonarmana, then sent back with an escort, released again after 3 interrogations, got across the street, was brought back and interrogated twice more. Have been home a week now, but can't say I count on it. Kay's fiancé wrote, he had a severe concussion of the brain but is recovering well, and they are to be married in October. I expect you know that young V was not so lucky, or in the end he may prove to have been luckier, who knows. I have called upon G.F. He wears a corset, satin waistcoat, gold watch chain, married, infant son, did not invite me to return. Do you have any word of Carlo? No one has heard from him since the party, and he is on my mind. I am going to go on and study for the bar examinations, since journalism, I find, does not pay. Let me hear from you. Believe me yours in constant affection, Tomas."
"It's from Mr. Brelava, isn't it?"
"Yes. You know his writing?"
"He wrote us several times when you were in prison. It was he that wrote us you had been arrested. It must have been hard for him. He never had good news for us. But he sounded so kind."
"Here, read it." He had to explain the initials to her.
"K, that's Karantai, you know, the novelist. He was hurt in Palazzi Street when they fought the guards. V is Vernoy, a student. He was killed. Givon Frenin, he was our college friend. He went home 3 years ago. He's a merchant in Solari now. They proscribed him anyhow. Poor Brelavi. He must feel lonely there."
"Who is Carlo?"
"Oh, San Giusto. His English letters to the paper were signed Carlo Franceschi. Must be a middle name."
"You've known him quite a long time."
"Well, I met him in Eisenar in 27, but I got to know him in July.
He was with you in the fighting."
He nodded. He glanced at her fine, rather pale face, her brown hair pulled back in a loose knot. She walked along stride for stride with him. In the 4 weeks he had been home, he had taken great comfort from her presence. Yet he had seldom spoken much with her about any but immediate concerns, Guida's health, farm matters, and accounts. She had learned to keep the books for her father, but when Itala had complimented her on the order and clarity of the accounts, she had sighed and said,
"I hate them. I do it because it's all he'll let me do. I keep them neat because I get lost at once if they're not. I hate figures. I'd rather clean the stables if I could."
Then she had laughed and made light of the matter. The great candor of her girlhood had become, in the woman, infinite reserve. Walking now beside her, brother and sister, Itala realized that he knew nothing of her life.
"I try to imagine," she said, "what you did down there, what your life was. The revolution, the insurrection," he said gently, "the insurrection. You say of the student, he was killed. I know how Mr. San Giusto's hand was hurt by a soldier with a gun hitting him. You spoke once about the fire. I know in a way what you did before that, before the prison. I read your paper. But I have never been able to understand, to imagine your life there, as if I lived in another world."
"The real one."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because there is nothing left of that life. It's finished, gone, scattered, overnight. There never was anything to it."
She walked on beside him.
"Dreams of youth," he said.
"All that has given my life any meaning for 5 years has been my belief that you were free, that you were working for freedom, doing what I couldn't do for me, even when you were in jail, then most of all, Itala."
He stopped, staggered by the passionate and unexpected reproach. Their eyes met for a moment. He saw that she knew what he could not say directly, that he had failed, that he was utterly defeated, that she knew it. And yet it was not of overwhelming importance to her. She did not see him as a failure or a fool. If she had, she would not have reproached him.
"But you must not trust me, Laura,"
he said desperately, all pretense of irony abandoned.
"When I used to talk about freedom, I didn't know what prison was. I talked about the good, but I didn't know evil. I am responsible for all the evil I saw, for the deaths. There is nothing I can do about it. All I can do is be silent, not to say what I'm saying now. Let me be silent. I don't want to do more harm."
"Life's the harm," Laura said quietly, dryly.
They walked on, coming in sight of the orchards above the Sorda house, the forested slopes above those.
"If they lifted the ban," Laura said, "would you go back to Krasnoy?"
"I don't know. It's not likely any time soon. In any case, I'm more use here while father's ill."
"Yes," she said, "of course. But he... someday he would fall ill. Someday he will die. That was always true."
"But I didn't believe it then," he said very low.
"I know," she said.
And he saw to his wonder that she was smiling.
"What I wanted to say was that you should not worry about that, about the estate. When the time comes to go. I'm nothing like Piera, but at least I can keep it going. I wanted you to be able to count on that."
"I just got home," he said. "For God's sake, are you trying to send me away again?"
"I am trying to make you see that no matter what the stupid police say, you are a free man," she said, fierce. "Am I not allowed to work for freedom? You are my freedom, Itale."
He could make no answer. When they came into the house, Guida called him into the library to discuss the grape harvest with him. Since the recurrence of his ailment, Guida had grudgingly admitted that everybody else, including the doctor, had been right, and he must go easy if he wanted to go on. Methodically, then, he rested at certain times, gave up certain labors and pursuits. He was visibly changed, his hair entirely gray, his hands and face less tanned, his spare figure looking both taller and frailer. Itale, entering the study, was struck by his resemblance to Laura, even in the tone of his voice. Laconic and amicable, they discussed the condition of the vines and the probable pace and order of the grape harvest if the temperate weather continued.
"If it gets hot," Guida said, bringing into their mutual view the frantic and relentless labor entailed by hot weather during grape harvest,
and Itala's relative inexperience, perhaps also his not yet fully recovered health.
"There's Brone, though."
"Aye, thank God. And San Giusto?"
"He's all right with orchards. You listen to Brone."
Itala smiled. He had been waiting for his father to admit that he approved of San Giusto. "He's all right with orchards," was the admission.
"Have you got the Sorrenti wagons?"
"Tomorrow morning."
"Who's going?"
"Karel."
Guida nodded.
"He's a steady man," Itala said. "He needs training."
"What for?"
"It's time we had an overseer."
He spoke with an indifferent bluntness that was new in him, though not in Guida. Guida was much offended by the proposal, but he was caught. He could not pretend that he was able to carry on the work alone any longer if Itale left, nor could he admit that the idea of Itale's going, implied in the suggestion, frightened him. He sat there on his couch under the windows, trying to think of an argument to defeat Itale's suggestion. He scowled, but little by little, and with singular conviction, he understood that there was no argument. If he had had power of veto, he would not even have sought an argument. He was not in control. Sometime in these past few weeks he had, without even noticing it, abdicated, and his son, as unknowingly, had come into his inheritance.
"Very well," he said. "You think Karel's the man?" Turning from the bookshelves to look at him, Itale caught in his face a shadow of pleasure and did not understand. He had expected a battle on this subject. It alarmed him that Guida should give in easily and, giving in, smile.
"Maybe I'm thinking ahead too far."
"Maybe," Guida said. "There's Pisy. Might do better than Karel. Go on now. I'm supposed to lie here till supper time."
Itale bowed and went out, and Guida lay back on the couch, obeying doctor's orders. He felt a little empty, lightened, the way a woman might feel after childbirth, he thought. Light, quiet, tired. A queer thing to be comparing himself to a woman, and a woman after childbirth. But there was Eleonora's face, the morning of Itale's birth. Her smile then, the center of his life. Nothing of his own. There was a great red sunset over the lake. The weather was turning. The next day was hot. The next, hotter. Itale was up at 4, at the vineyards and the winery all day till dark. He saw nothing at all in the world beyond the vines, the grapes, the boxes, baskets, carts and wagons loaded with the grapes, the pressing tubs in a stone courtyard stained and reeking with must, the brief dark coolness of the storage cellars dug into the hillside, the swing of the sun across the hot September sky. Then that work was done, and other harvests from the fields and orchards were coming in. Silent and absorbed, irascible when pushed past the limit of his strength, otherwise patient, Itale got on with the work and never raised his eyes from it to look back or ahead. Most of his waking hours were spent outdoors, in the fields and orchards, and more of his time in the farm buildings than in the house itself. He came in only to eat and sleep. When the work let up, he went hunting several times with Brone's grandson Pisy and Berka Gavre, with whom he had struck up a taciturn kind of friendship, or with San Giusto. He went into Portaceca as seldom as possible and paid no calls. When Rodenne or the Sorrentis or other neighbors came to call, he often stood in for Guida, receiving them with stiff courtesy, seeing to it that hospitality was prompt and unlimited, and then sitting silent, unparticipating, while they talked. His mother watched him and said nothing, so she had watched Guida for 30 years. Often at her housework or at night, lying awake in autumn darkness, she thought of the merry child, the awkward, gallant boy, and the man she had seen him, barely seen him, becoming. It had not been this man, this somber, restless, silent man, this second Guida, yet not like Guida as she had first known him, for Guida as a young man had rejoiced in his work and had suffered no defeat. In Eleonora's heart those October nights was the same bitter resentment against the world that offers so vast a chance to the young spirit, and, when it comes to the point, gives so narrow a lot, the same scorn and resentment that her daughter had felt, that Piera had felt, and that she recognized in them but with little hope for them and none for herself. San Giusto worked along with Itale, made himself useful and pleasant in the house, went sailing in Falcone. Carantai's fiancée had sent a necessarily cryptic warning. The government had San Giusto's name and description, and were watching for him at the borders as a professional revolutionary. At this, San Giusto, as if accepting a challenge, announced that he would walk out, over the mountains, past Val Altesma, where there were no border stations.
"What for?" Itale said.
"Where to?"
"To France."
"Don't leave me in the lurch now."
"I'll go when we have the pears done."
"You can't cross the mountains in winter."
"Next spring," San Giusto said. And he stayed, so easy, steady, and cheerful a man that Itale, in his present mood, took him quite for granted, never questioning the character of their congeniality, scarcely remembering its origins. He forgot even that before their meeting lay a life of which he knew nothing. One day in late October, the first day of rain, he came by the pear orchards to pick up San Giusto and could not find him.
He tethered his horse and the one he had led and hunted the orchard aisles for 20 minutes before he came on his friend standing with a peculiar expression under a tree. Off down an alley, a garnet red skirt and white blouse twinkled, vanished. The rain pattered softly, multitudinously, on leaf and grass.
"I've been calling,"
he accused, wet and annoyed.
"Yes, I heard."
San Justo blinked, pushed off from the tree, came along beside him.
"Was that Marta's Anina?"
"Yes."
Itales strode along through the wet grass for a while.
"She's barely 15.
"I know."
They mounted their horses, rode in silence. Suddenly San Justo began to laugh, and Itales flushed red.
I know, but someone must talk to pretty girls, look at them, nay? What are they pretty for? I feel responsible, of course. I will not make her pregnant."
"I know that."
"Then why are you so angry?"
San Justo said in a slightly different tone.
"Angry with me? What do you want of me? You want dignity, abstinence, romantic passion. I have had all that. I would rather kiss pretty girls in an orchard. I am 10 years older than you, sad to say. I have had the romantic passion. I was in love, betrothed to a young lady. That was in 1819. Oh, God, I was in love. I wrote poetry. I got thin. So also I got sent to prison, and got still more thin. And she married in Milan. She married an Austrian officer. I learnt it when I came out of prison. So there I am. Austria has taken my children from me before they were ever born. So I cross the mountains and become nobody, always in exile. But I have nothing more to do with that ever again, with love, with young ladies. But if I meet Anina and she smiles, Jesu Maria, Itale, what do you want?"
Itale stammered,
"Sorry, Francesco,"
and was red and silent. But as his shame began to cool, he wondered a little at the strength, the circumstantiality, of San Justo's disclaimer. The Italian, meantime, placid as ever, made his young horse prance, lifted his face to the rain falling from the ragged drifting clouds, and hummed. He burst out in a strong tenor, "Un soave non so che." Note, Italian, a sweet something or other, from the start of a love duet in La Cenerentola, or Cinderella, 1817, by Gioacchino Rossini, 1792-1868. End note.
"Ha, that pig Rossini. You know he wrote an oratorio for Metternich, the Holy Alliance."
Note. Though Rossini was not an admirer of the reactionary Holy Alliance of Russia, Austria, and Prussia, he did accept a commission from Metternich to write 2 cantatas for the Congress of Verona in 1822, one of which, La Santa Alleanza, or The Holy Alliance, is now lost. End note.
"Musicians are idiots, blessed idiots. God has exempted them from reason. Look there, your count has already picked his pippin apples."
Note. The product of unintentional breeding of 2 varieties. End note.
"Maybe we start? That little countess is very wise with her orchards."
Itale made no answer. They trotted along through the rain, towards the house on the shore. Before he saw the Valtorskars on his second night home, he had been nervous, but as soon as he saw them, his apprehension and excitement had vanished. He had greeted Count Orlant with affection, grieved to see how the robust man had aged. Beside him was Piera, hardly changed, he thought, though she must be 21 or 22 now, still small, a round girlish face, a timid girlish manner, a smile, and a few polite words. The vividness and vitality of her childhood were gone, leached away, no doubt, by this lonely life, replaced by no richer being, no opulence of womanhood. She was sterile, faded before flower. He saw this with a kind of luxuriation in the bitterness of being once again confirmed in the conviction that had come upon him first, clearly, in the wayside inn at Bara, the conviction that all he had worked for, that his whole understanding of freedom, had been delusion, moonshine, verbiage. Estenskar had seen it. This girl in her way had seen it. The Jew Moishe knew it. And the girl in Bara, the girl with dull eyes and thick, chapped, dirty hands, knew nothing but her own wants, which would never be filled, and knew it better than them all. There is no freedom. Laura was in the garden behind the house, in a tent-like cape and shapeless hat, pruning the roses her grandfather had planted. The year's last flowering was over, and the leaves looked rusty on the gnarled, rain-wet stalks. She looked round as the two horsemen came down the road and held up her pruning shears in salute.
"Ah, there," said San Justo unexpectedly, made a sweeping gesture, and said nothing else.
Laura came to the garden fence.
"Drowned rats," she said.
"You prune back your roses too early."
"I'm just taking off dead wood and canes."
Itale consciously held back his horse and watched them, the tall woman smiling, her fine thin hands wet with rain, and the man, handsome and vigorous on his horse, asking her something about Mandevilla suaviolens.
"Yes, by the front walk," she said. "The only one in the valley. Grandfather planted it."
"Here, I take the horse around and come back."
"I'll take him," Itale said. San Justo gave Itale the reins, vaulted the fence, and went off with Laura through the wet autumnal garden.
"Nothing more to do with that ever again, eh?"
thought Itale, leading the gray horse to the stables, and his heart was confused between tenderness and rancor. October ended full of rain and mist, with a few last golden evenings. November came in cold. In mid-month, Itale, waking one morning, saw from his window the hunter whitened with snow against a dark gray sky. Work slackened. The farm was settling into its winter patience. Though the roads were foul, there was much calling and visiting among the farms and households of Val Malafrena. Every afternoon there were people in the front room, women's voices, Eva trotting past with a tray of cakes and strawberry wine and cherry brandy, or else Cos was bringing out the gig to drive Eleonora and Laura to the Panes or the Sorrentais. In the cold weather, Guides seldom went out. He worked at small jobs, the kind of harness mending, tool sharpening, furniture repairing that he had used to leave to servants or get done in a half hour before breakfast. He took his rest on the couch in the library dutifully, and then came to the front room, if there were no visitors, to sit down and work his way slowly and thoughtfully, with long pauses, through Virgil. His copy of the Aeneid had been his own in school, then Itale's, and was full of schoolboy glosses. He held it off on his knees to read, being very far-sighted. It was strange to Itale, who had never seen him read, to see him sit there perfectly still, the book a yard from his eyes, so that it appeared that he did not so much read as absorb by long, silent watching the story in the scarred and scribbled book, the tenderness, heroism, and pain. If visitors came, he greeted them, but often returned to his solitude in the library. If it was Eleonora, Laura, Piera, he stayed with them. And Itale, too, when he came in at dusk and took off his sheepskin coat, was content to be in the company of his family. Then, not before. He was at the mercy of a driving restlessness, the same strained, unreasoning energy that had taken him back from the Sovena to Krasnoy, through the 60 hours of the August insurrection, on out of Krasnoy to Bara, to Malafrena, through the vintage, through the autumn. Now that it was winter and there was less to do, he made work, or walked, or hunted. Only when he was physically worn out could he turn home and be content to sit down by the fire, talk with Guida about the work, with San Justo about events in Greece and Belgium. With the women, he found little to say. He came in one night early in December. Rain had followed snow. The ground was boggy, the air heavy with a soft, chill mist. Despite his tireless activity, he had found that he still got cold easily and suffered a good deal from it, as if he carried Saint-Lazare with him in the marrow of his bones. He was very cold this evening, and headed for the hearth directly. It was a Saturday. Emmanuel and Pernetta were there, Count Orlant and Piera. Even Auntie, now 100 years old, was ensconced in a straight chair with a ball of red wool in her lap. Talking, they had let the night come in. It was dark except for the firelight. San Giusto had been telling them something about his years in England. He was as good as any storybook to this audience. And Count Orlant summed up the subject.
A fine, enterprising race, the English. They've done wonders in astronomy.
Guida looked up as his son came by his chair in the firelit dusk of the room.
You're here too, Itale, he said.
The dark room, four candles, the room where death was, and his father's voice.
I'm here.
He sat down on the hearth seat near Guida's chair and put out his hands to the fire, repressing a tremor, feeling he would never get warm.
Itale, dear, said his mother in serene greeting, are you starved? Eva's having trouble with the chicken. Old George, he's taking hours, and all he's fit for is soup in the first place. And the mutton's drying up. But there really is no use even trying to argue with Eva any longer. After all, she's run that kitchen 30 years. We must all just get old and cross together, although it's rather hard on you young ones. But your teeth are better.
Is it still raining? Count Orlant asked.
Aye, harder.
The conversation sprang up again, he and Guida sitting silent. Piera, too, was silent, across the hearth from him. She spoke little when the families were together. Itale had seen her and Laura talking away a whole afternoon here by the hearth, or down on the slope by the boathouse. But she seemed to talk only to Laura. He glanced at her, thinking how San Giusto had more than once remarked on her beauty. San Giusto was rather given to finding women beautiful, but did he himself, in this case, for some reason, merely persuade himself that she was plain? Her features certainly were good, her figure unexceptional. But she was plain. No wonder, with her life spent between Malafrena and Portaceca, 2 years in a convent school in Eisenach, a broken engagement to a widower in his 40s, an aging household, filling up her time by trying to run the estate, no wonder she was dry and colorless, a withered branch. Life had defeated her before she had got fairly started. She was weak, and had been given no weapons with which to delay the inevitable, to fight back a while before she lost the hopeless struggle. It was not her fault. The hot, bright fire had begun to sting his face pleasantly, and he felt the heat of it through his shirt. She had put up a hand to screen her face from it. She looked at him above that delicate, red-lit hand.
"We haven't seen you for several days," he said, wanting to be kind.
"No,"
she said.
"The weather's been so bad. I have a book for you. I finally remembered to bring it along."
"A book?"
"Yes. It's yours, and I haven't any more use for it."
Itale stared at her.
"You've probably forgotten. It was a long time ago you lent it to me, 5 years ago. It's called The New Life."
"I didn't lend it to you. I gave it to you."
"I'm giving it back," said Piera.
Emmanuel was watching the two of them, profiled against the fire. Itale looked floored. Evidently, Piera had got tired of being overlooked. She would know how to make herself felt once she put her mind to it. She had become formidable in her competence. Berke Gavre, her obedient lieutenant, had told Emmanuel that she had doubled the cash income of Valtorsa in 2 years and was laying out the profit on improvements. Emmanuel had seen her at estate business in Portaceca and had acted as her lawyer or legal advisor several times. He had found her both prudent and decisive, an excellent client, though he would have been happier with her qualities if they belonged to a young man.
"She's extremely strong-willed," he had said to Pernetta, who had replied,
"And you would prefer her to be weak-minded?"
Unfairly, he thought. But if she could shake Itala out of his silence, more power to her. To do that would require strength and wits. It was easy to floor Itala, he was never on guard, but it was not easy to touch or hold or change him.
"Piera," Itala said across the hearth,
I'll write something in it, if you like, to make it more of a present. No, here ends the new life, with affection, from Piera Valtorskar. Would that do? It's right over there in my sewing bag on the chest.
Piera, listen, it was a long time ago, but times change. I won't take it back. Burn it if you like.
Itala got up, strode off to the south windows, and stood there with his back to them all. Piera sat by the fire, her face half in shadow, half lit red by the flames, had turned to watch Itala. She did not move, her hands lay clasped together in her lap. Dinner was announced at last. As Itala went into the dining room with Pernetta, he watched his sister and San Giusto ahead of him. Laura and Francesco. Sonnets to fair ladies, it was too much. He had been a fool to bring the Italian here, and San Giusto, a homeless, aimless man, should know better than to play at Petrarch while hiding from the imperial police. Note: Francesco Petrarca, also known as Petrarch, 1304 to 1374, helped to make the sonnet into a vehicle for expressing courtly love with a volume of poems praising a woman, real or ideal, named Laura. Some identify the beloved in the sonnets as Laura de Noves, a married aristocrat with whom Petrarch had very little actual contact. End note. What did he or Laura think could come of it? They were sleepwalking, play-acting. Yesterday, San Giusto had said to him, "I wish all my money was not bound up in our land, in the Piedmont. I think I could be a good farmer here, 50 acres of orchard like that one." Then he had laughed, and let his lively horse out and cantered on ahead of Itala, singing, "Un soave non so che." At table, serious now, he said across the mutton, "Itala, your sister has explained Carantai's letter, perhaps." A second letter from Carantai had come that week, containing some news of mutual friends and recent events, and towards the end, in the midst of a sentence about something else, a curious clause. "Now that I am no longer a writer of fiction." They had discussed it at some length, as all letters, all outside news, always get discussed in winter in the Montaigne, and had speculated on the implications of that clause, arriving at no explanation.
"I wondered," Laura said, "if he means that he hasn't recovered from his injury, that he's not well enough to write. It seems his marriage has been put off. And you said, when his first letter came, how much his handwriting had changed."
"What happened to him?" Pernetta inquired.
"A saber cut, in the charge on Palazzi Street. A head wound."
"Poor chap," Count Orlant said.
"I thought he meant," Itala began, and stopped.
Laura's theory was sickeningly plausible.
"It can't be that," he said.
"He can get better,"
San Giusto said, calm as always, hopeful as always, but revealing for once, unknowing, perhaps to Itala's eyes only, the foundation of his hopefulness and calmness, the intense, unchanging sadness that was the condition of his life.
"I enjoyed his book a good deal, in places," Pernetta said.
"I loved it," Eleonora said. "I wish you'd give it back, Pernetta. You've had it 3 years, and I've been wanting to see it. When I got near the end, it was so upsetting."
"You mean you never finished it, Lele?"
Emmanuel inquired, grinning.
"I didn't want to. I was afraid he was going to die.
I know it's silly to cry over books, but I always used to cry over the new Eloise, and there's a great deal more to cry over in this one.
It has a happy ending, Mama,
Laura said with her broad, sweet smile.
I kept thinking that the young man, what's his name, Pernetta said, Lieve, was like Itale.
Of course, that's what made me cry,
Eleonora said.
Carantai had the book planned out before he ever knew me,
Itale said with covert violence.
Nonetheless, it can be true to life,
San Giusto remarked.
He writes about his generation.
But it's not true to life. It's a great book, but it's in some ways a false one. Carantai himself is absolutely level-headed and honest, but the book's all heights and depths and exaggerations. People don't behave like that.
Why write a romance about unromantic people?
Emmanuel inquired.
It's a great book, of course. It's the best we have. But he could have done... he could do much greater things.
And will,
San Giusto said, raising his wine glass as if in a private toast.
God willing.
The conversation drifted on. The good heavy food came and was eaten. The plain familial faces in the candlelight brightened with conviviality. Itale, doubly shaken, avoided looking at Piera at all, and tried to avoid the thought of Carantai. He drank more wine than usual, but his unhappy self-consciousness continued. They were there, around him, his own people, but he was not one of them. They were at home, all of them, but him. What have I done? He thought. Why have I no home?
You wrote about some man once down there,
Guida said to him without preliminary,
that knew my father. Who was he?
Startled from his brooding, he tried to describe Count Helescar. His description sounded inevitably like one of the characters in Carantai's novel and fascinated his hearers. They asked questions, leading him on to explain how he had met old Helescar through his son, and to mention the Paludescars, Enrique and Luisa.
"Countess Luisa," said Pernetta. "She's in the book.
They're not alike.
The one in the book is very beautiful,"
Laura said, not innocently.
"So is the one in flesh and blood,"
Emmanuel said soberly, almost with reproof.
"Yes," Piera said. "She is. I think the most beautiful woman I ever saw."
Where did you see her?
Itale demanded, shocked into speech by the idea, incredible to him, of Luisa and Piera in the same room.
In Eisnar, at my fiancé's house.
I knew she was good,
Eleonora said, speaking soberly as Emmanuel had done.
I'm glad she's beautiful, too.
She looked at Itale with a faint anxiety or query.
She's to be married,
Laura said.
It's in Mr. Carantai's letter.
To Georgia Helescar, this spring,
Itale said.
I drink to her happiness, said Emmanuel,
and they raised their glasses and drank to her, and talked of other things.